Welcome to our newest adventure for first responder wellness. No one fights alone. In-depth conversations about mental health and culture in the first responder space. We're joined by your co-hosts, Austin Pedersen and Brad Shepard.
Hey, welcome back to No One Fights Alone podcast. It's just me again today. Austin's off on adventures of an executive director of Chateau Health and Wellness. But I'm excited to have Dr. Evan Peskin with me today. Doc, welcome to the No One Fights Alone podcast.
Thank you. It's an honor to be on. I've been looking forward to this.
Oh, this is awesome. You know, we were just having a brief conversation there, and I'll just be transparent. We were talking a little bit about kind of the teeing up the podcast, and I thought, man, this is so good. Right off the bat, we weren't even 5 minutes in the conversation. I said, let's hit record on this and just keep going. And
I'm a talker, man. That's the problem. Is you're gonna have to. I tell my patients, or actually my wife tells me to tell my patients, that they should preload with aspirin or ibuprofen for the headache they're inevitably going to get from dealing with me.
Well, as soon as you said I used to be a stand-up comedian, I was all in, man. You had me hello right there.
It's good memories, good times. I love it. I wish I got to crack some more jokes, you know, at work and with patients. Make some people kind of uncomfortable, but life is serious, so I don't have to be. That's the rule.
Well, life is too serious, so we got to have some laughs along the way, especially in our culture. And I think we'll go into that. We'll talk a little bit about that. I teed some of that up for us, but so let's back up here. And some of our conversation was, how does Dr. Evan Peskin get to, I'm sorry, for our listeners, let's preamble this. Dr. Peskin is a pain management doctor, interventional chronic pain management physician, and anesthesiologist. Sorry, that didn't come out very well. And then co-founder of Sanctuary Healthcare. Did I get that correct?
That is all spot on. Yeah. So I'm trained as an anesthesiologist, and then I subspecialized in being a chronic pain or interventional pain doctor. So the vast majority of what I do is help take care of people who have degenerative pain, traumatic pain, post-surgical pain, pain secondary to infection, pain secondary to diseases or inflammation. There's a lot of different roads that unfortunately lead to pain. So I'm lucky enough that I get to spend most of my day trying to give people some happiness, trying to give people some quality of life. And then kind of just like what you alluded to, I'm the co-founder of Sanctuary Healthcare. And we are a small concierge style private clinic that specializes in ketamine infusions. And we do ketamine infusions for two large categories of patients. The first one is for chronic pain, specifically nerve pain is really what responds very well to that. And the second big category is for mental health care diagnoses, primarily depression, trauma, and anxiety. And those are probably the big two buckets that we service.
Well, I love this. And I know we're going to get into some really great conversation pieces. I already sensed several rabbits I'd like to chase in this, but let's back up here a little bit, because we were initially talking right before we jumped on about kind of how does a guy arrive to this type of specialty? And I was fascinated. You're very passionate about this. So mom and dad, that intrigued me.
Sure. So my father is my role model. He very much set out, what are the rules in life for me? How you carry yourself, how you conduct yourself, how you take care of others. So my father is an OBGYN. He's practiced as an OBGYN for 30 years, and he's subspecialized in vitro fertilization. And he told me very early on, when I started becoming interested in medicine, he said, the golden rule is patients come first. You take care of others the way that you would expect others to take care of your loved ones. So when I meet patients for the first time in the clinic, in any clinic, I tell them my same two rules, which is safety comes first and like family. I expect the same for them that I would expect someone to do for my wife, my brother, my mother, my father. That's it. Nothing less than that. And so I think it is kind of a curious journey of how I ended up, myself and my father ended up co-founding and running a ketamine infusion clinic. So ketamine is an anesthetic, a drug, a dissociative anesthetic that's been around for around 60 years. It is well studied. It is well understood. But I think the value that it has for different applications have really only begun to be realized in the past 20 to 30 years. So initially, it was created and used. I mean, in the very beginning, how it was chemically created, it was created as a veterinary anesthetic. It was something that was initially used in the 50s and like early 60s for anesthesia for veterinary procedures. They then realized, one of my mentors, Dr. Amanda Saab, calls ketamine the all-in-one anesthetic. It can be given nasally, orally, intramuscularly, intravenously. If you're really feeling spicy, rectally. You know, it's very much, you know, dealer's choice for that. But it offers analgesia, pain control. It offers amnesia. It limits memory formation. If you're having surgery, you don't really want to remember the surgery. And it offers anesthesia, or that dissociated state that allows someone to have surgery. And because it was this all-in-one anesthetic that can be given through any route, it was the preferred anesthetic during the Vietnam War, because you could carry a syringe of it. And if someone got shot in a field, you could give them intramuscular, intravenous, oral, nasal ketamine, and then remove a bullet, remove shrapnel, you know, and have people be comfortable, pain control, and not fighting having a surgery. So that was kind of 60s and 70s.
What's been the increase in the value? When you were saying it's been around, you know, 60 plus years, but in the last 20 years, it's seen this. Is that where we're starting to see this increase in this use of ketamine in the mental health field? Is that we're? I mean, did something happen? Did a switch flip? Did a button get pressed saying, "Oh wow, we can also use this for depression and trauma"? Or
for sure. So there's remarkable trailblazers that have come. And the one institution that I always give the most credit to is Johns Hopkins. They did a really remarkable job of recognizing that this anesthetic had other use to help treat mental health. And it is a remarkably unique medication. So the problem is mental health doesn't really have super great medication available. The typical antidepressant is an SSRI, and it has a success rate of around 50 to 60%. Like, it's not really phenomenal rates of success.
And some pretty significant side effects.
That's an understatement. So yes, some more than significant side effects. And unfortunately, the pharmacology and the medications that have been available for mental health are really quite poor. One of my close friends, Dr. Stephen Pappas, who is both a veteran and a special force operator, as well as an MD physician, he is someone who I hold in the highest regards. And he worked in the VA in Chicago, and he talks to me in extreme frustration that for these young gentlemen who return from military service with PTSD and PTSD symptoms, they are given classes of medications that are called antipsychotics. So A, they're not really helping address the underlying problem. And B, you want to talk about side effects. It can lead to long-term motion disorders. It can create diabetes. It can lead to pancreatic failure. Like, they are not super fantastic medications. And ketamine kind of came onto the field with some slowly growing research of recognizing that it is not just a symptomatic control medication, but it is something that is helping change the underlying problem. So what I mean by that is John Crystal, who I believe was the lead psychiatrist at Yale, put it as benzodiazepines, anxiolytics, these anti-anxiety medications, they work while they are in your bloodstream. While they are measurable in your bloodstream, it helps with the symptoms. And when they're gone, it's gone. But for ketamine, it's not the medication in the bloodstream and the active amount in your blood that makes a difference. It's the changes from the ketamine. So ketamine is a medication that can actually help restructure, reshape nerve connections and nerve activity within your brain and within some higher cognitive areas of your actual nervous system. So I have my favorite analogy for this, and I wish I came up with this and I didn't, but this is called the snowy hill analogy, where the whole idea is ketamine helps you create new nerve patterns, helps you create new ways of thinking, and allows your brain to do that. So if you were to take a sled to the top of a snowy hill and sled down, it creates that divot in the snow. It creates that path. You pick up your sled and you walk to the top of the hill, you put the sled down, odds are it will probably follow that same path the second time. But when you go 5 times and 10 times and 100 times, that path is so well worn in the snow that if you want to go left or if you want to go right, it's not really possible. That pathway is so reinforced that it is the automatic pathway you take. And what ketamine allows for is a fresh snowfall. There are literal connections in your brain, and you kind of, the easiest way to kind of explain it is memory. When you type in your garage code every single day, it's autopilot. You know that garage code because it is a well-worn, reinforced path in your brain. There are literally nerve pathways that become stronger, that become easier to access because it is constantly being accessed. Trying to remember your neighbor's, you know, last 4 digits of their phone number that you had to call twice in 1980, it's not really there. It's somewhere, it's buried, but it's not well accessed. It's not a constantly repeated pathway, so it's not strongly reinforced. The problem is with depression and trauma and anxiety is those thought patterns are not just this ethereal cloud, hard to define. They're hard to see, but there literally are pathways in your brain that become stronger and more reinforced the more you think about them. And unfortunately, it's not always nice pathways. It's often fairly significantly negative pathways that can become more and more reinforced. And so what ketamine allows for is these treatment-resistant conditions. You can become easier to engage with treatment. We hear from patients that they feel like they were stuck in therapy or they were stuck and not making any progress, and ketamine kind of allowed for a widening of their vision and allowed them to kind of engage in treatments that they had failed previously. We get calls from psychiatrists and psychologists all the time who state that they felt like this patient, John, had come for months and months and months and was saying the same things, but after engaging with some of the ketamine therapy, his thought process became more malleable, became more able to be reshaped. People are able to kind of make breakthroughs and make changes that otherwise the walls are very reinforced.
So for our listeners, I'm a very lay person. I'm pretty ignorant of a lot of this as well. But for our listeners, if we break this down a little bit, just some really simple questions related to this process, and I have several. You've given some great information, so I want to follow up here on several different chase some rabbits. But is this this drug ketamine? Is this something, mm-hmm, if a person takes it, they're on it for life, or is this a one and done? Is this a dosage dwindle off? Can you speak to that a little bit about what the process is if somebody, and then we'll deep dive a little bit about kind of the ketamine itself.
Sure. 100%. So I think what's really important, and I've kind of tried to allude to it, which is really important to Sanctuary, is this is not a one size fits all medication. Anybody who tells you that a medication works 100% of the time or works for everybody is not a physician, is not a healthcare practitioner. That is a marketer.
Right.
That is never true. So there is not a one size fits all script for this.
Well, I think for our community, one of the things that really is important, I think most people are cautious of, we get into this addictive framework. And is this something, because I know that it's on some levels, it's been labeled as a hallucinogenic type drug. So is this something that's going to be, hit my addictive framework within my life? Should I stay away from it? So that's kind of the mindset of the question, the thought behind the question there.
100%. So there's I wish I could screen share and show you right now, but there's a really good meta analysis that looks at kind of on this table, on one axis of it, is it how safe is the drug? Which is essentially asking how big of a dose is it between effective dose and a lethal dose or a dangerous dose. And on the other axis is addiction rating, or how much and how often you're exposed to it, leaning to how often people develop an addiction habit with it. So again, this is an anesthetic. And unfortunately, people are addicted to a wide variety of medications. This has been rated as substantially less addictive than narcotics, than tobacco, than cocaine, than methamphetamines, all of these medications. And what's also extremely important, if you look at literature, unfortunately, ketamine is kind of a dissociative anesthetic. You called it a psychedelic or a hallucinogen. Ketamine is what's called a dose-dependent anesthetic. So depending on the dose that you use, what happens is totally different. There is sub-hypnotic dosing, extremely low dosing, that's essentially used for relaxation. As an anesthesiologist, I sometimes used it in post-surgery recovery because people woke up a lot calmer and a lot more comfortable.
Sure.
There is the dissociative dosing, which is used for surgery. You know, there's a dose where when I was, again, working in trauma anesthesia, we used ketamine because it doesn't drop your blood pressure. It doesn't drop your heart rate. It keeps you breathing by yourself as opposed to narcotics or propofol. So for trauma patients who came in with a lot of blood loss, we would give them ketamine. Ketamine as a dose-dependent medication, how we use it at Sanctuary is dose-dependent. We have a very specific spectrum of milligrams per kilogram per hour that we use based on your prior history, based on the diagnosis we're treating, based on your medical history, and based on how you responded to the last treatment. So it's not like you, Brad, come in and your neighbor, like Steve, comes in and Kevin from across the street comes in and all of you guys get 200 milligrams. I don't care that you're, you know, 75 kilograms, he's 30 kilograms, and he's 150. It is a dose-dependent and weight-based dosing medication. So it is something that, used correctly and used by physicians, it is a very low risk of addiction, tolerance, or dependence. That being said, again, I want you to know all information. Sure. It was something that was used throughout the 90s and 2000s as a recreational club drug, specifically in the UK and in London, to the point that when they surveyed teen drug usage in London and in the UK, something like 25% of teenagers had done it in a recreational setting. And again, we talked about you can take it through all these different routes. They took powdered ketamine and snorted it. And I don't recommend anybody to do that. So not very weight-based, not very medical. That is purely recreational. I'll tell you explicitly, as an anesthesiologist, as someone in the operating room, fentanyl is an extremely good drug for the operating room. Extremely good medication for the operating room. Fentanyl outside of the operating room is a totally deadly. Different ballpark.
Yeah, deadly.
This is not even.
No, I appreciate thing. That, and I think for our listeners that would be, and certainly in my mind, it certainly is is one of the questions that I think is prevalent too. You know, you start learning about things, and there's certain, you know, layperson cautions and fears that come up in approaching these new endeavors. And this is, again, this is a great opportunity to educate our listeners as to what this really is about. So one of the other things I kind of want to steer you towards is application. So you were initially you were talking about trauma and PTSD and depression, and frame this in a question. How does ketamine help those specifically? Let's get in the weeds a little bit about the application of ketamine for those things that maybe our community of listeners out here are battling.
Sure. So let's split into those two large buckets that I talked about, pain and mental health care diagnoses. So let's talk about mental health care first, because that's what's gotten the most public attention. That's what most people are aware of most recently for ketamine, is for this trauma, anxiety, depression, primarily. Those are really the three big categories that are most often sorted into this. So ketamine works chemically as an NMDA receptor antagonist. So it changes nerve kind of activity, as well as changes nerve connection between areas of the brain and areas of other nerve concentration. So it is something that, you know, they do these studies called fMRI, functional MRI. And we can see people's, you know, they use it for, you know, a bunch of studies, a bunch of research for how people respond to stimulus, how people respond to music, how people talk, where the area of your brain lights up when you hear, you know, something you care about versus when you see something scary. That's how they've helped map the areas of the brain that respond to motion and auditory input and memory and the frontal cortex being higher, cognitive functioning and everything like that. So fMRIs for patients with depression, patients with anxiety, and patients specifically with trauma and a whole spectrum of trauma, PTSD, sexual assaults. There's, you know, there's a variety of different, unfortunately, shades and colors of trauma. fMRI will show decrease in activity and decrease in functionality of areas of the brain. And those areas have been shown to kind of not only regenerate, but show further activity post-treatment with ketamine. So in an extremely simplified nutshell, ketamine doesn't just control symptoms like SSRIs do for depression or like benzodiazepines do for anxiety. It helps create and reform nerve connections that lead to address the underlying structural issues that can perpetuate and continue these conditions.
Is there a process by which, and we're talking about rewiring the neural pathways, neuroplasticity, is there a process by which once you take ketamine, you think, because my experience, albeit very layperson again, is if you concentrate on certain things, you'll rewire the pathway from, you know, let's just use a dramatic example, from thinking this, you know, negative framework versus a really positive framework. It takes a lot of work. Like, it takes a lot of concentration. Is there a something that you do when you take ketamine to do that? Are you concentrating on something, or is this just kind of work on its own accord?
So, I mean, that's a great question, because what you're driving at, and apparently you know a lot more than you think you know, is the idea of integration. That during this period of increased neuroplasticity, of increased ability to kind of be more receptive, rework these patterns in our brain, reformat these constant habits and these repeated thoughts. When you get the actual infusion, it isn't the dosage that's used appropriately intravenously. It is an anesthetic. You're in a much more kind of comfortable, less receptive state. People are kind of very sedate. You're kind of very comfortable. It's a very low dose anesthetic. Just like people get colonoscopies and they get propofol, that's not really the time to write your, you know, dissertation. That's not really the time to compose music.
That's right.
It's a little troublesome.
You're gonna bury your soul.
That's exactly the time. Yeah. I mean, people think in vino veritas, they think alcohol does it. Let me ask your anesthesiologist. Those 30 seconds before you go down for a colonoscopy, the stories.
They hear it all, don't they?
My God.
Please stop talking.
Yes, for sure. But back to the integration. There is no one, again, this is really exciting for me. And Brad, you and I kind of talked about it, barely touched on it in the beginning before we started filming. But my father's an OBGYN. And so in his career and in his time practicing medicine, he was not only a witness, but he was someone who was actively involved with kind of altering and shaping the field of in vitro fertilization. That was like, he was there for the birth, the genesis of a new field of medicine. And that's not really common, man. Like, there's not really, you don't get a brand new cardiology every week. It's not like, oh, you know, we just found a new organ, or like, you've never believed that no one's ever treated the skin with dermatology. It's very rare that a new field of medicine develops. I'm really lucky, because the way that I look at it is we are actively watching the development of the field of psychedelic medicine, or how these medications like ketamine, MDMA, psilocybin are going to completely change the fields of psychiatry, psychology, neurology, pain medicine. Like, it's an honor and it's humbling to watch this field develop. So the reason why I say that is because all of this data started coming out from Johns Hopkins in the 90s and 2000s. There was kind of a dip off during like war on drugs. A lot of stuff kind of got shut down because even though it's for a medical purpose, even for a lot of these things, the activity for it and the funding for it kind of disappeared. And it's only really picked back up over the last decade or so. There isn't enough data to answer what is the gold standard. If you have a heart attack in Mississippi or Maine or Minnesota, there is a gold standard way of managing that heart attack. When it comes to integration for ketamine, there is no 100% gold standard. And at Sanctuary, we've done our own research. We've done our own development of protocols. We have patients who are being treated for mental health care conditions work with their mental health care providers approximately 24 hours after the treatment. That's when people tend to be 100% most coherent. You're back to functionality within hours. We treat professional athletes. We've treated NFL alumni who come in for a treatment at 8 a.m., leave at 10 a.m. and are coaching Little League games at 1 p.m. You know, like, they are back to functionality. For pure safety, we ask people not to make legal decisions or drive for 24 hours, but people are essentially back to coherence within minutes to hours after their infusion. For the purpose of treatment, we ask patients to coordinate their integration sessions approximately 24 hours after the session, so after the infusion. So there's one other thing that we've kind of talked about very briefly that I think needs to be addressed, which is surprising to no one, healthcare and big pharma are kind of run with maybe not the most kind-hearted motives. Sometimes, I mean, I know that's crazy. I'm sure everyone thinks that, you know,
me.
These large pharma.
This is
that's it's shocking. This is probably the first time anyone has ever said this.
Maybe we should get on a podcast later and talk about that.
Yeah, when I get shot through the window, don't be surprised that it happens. Yeah. Man. So everything I'm saying is my opinion about this.
Sure.
And I don't want to speak for other physicians, and I don't want to demonize anyone. And I understand these studies to run, you know, safety studies, efficacy studies, all these things are hundreds of millions of dollars to do it safely and to do it appropriately. So I understand it's not easy. I'm going to put that caveat in. But ketamine was used and synthesized in the 60s. I think it was patented in 64, if I'm not mistaken. And the patent expired 2.5 decades later. So nobody owned the intellectual property for ketamine hydrochloride, which is the pure molecule, which is ketamine. The problem was all of the FDA indication, all of the on-label use was for general anesthesia. That's it, full stop, period. That's what it was approved for. So when all these other studies came out and all this data came out and all this research and case studies and people saying, this helped me and this changed my life, the problem was, in order to run those FDA studies to get an on-label indication, it was extremely expensive, extremely difficult. And because of that, no company wanted to run the studies on a generic medication. So I didn't realize, again, my problem is, we all see this, man. Athletes talk in a sentence structure that makes complete sense to them, and the rest of us, it's gibberish. So my problem is I slip into things that make a lot of sense to me, and I don't realize that I'm essentially speaking a foreign language. So when I say an on-label indication, that is incredibly important, because on-label means that the FDA has approved it and most insurances should cover it. Off-label does not mean experimental. It doesn't mean unsafe. Something like 20% of medications that are prescribed in the United States by physicians are off-label, which means all on-label means is this specific medication at this specific dosage for this specific route of administration for this specific diagnosis is A-OK. So like this blood pressure medicine, lisinopril, for the dosage of 2.5 to 20 milligrams once 2 to 3 times a day for the diagnosis of hypertension is on orally is on label. Anything outside of those metrics are off label. So if I have a 100-year-old woman who weighs 65 pounds soaking wet, and I say a 5 milligrams is even too much for her, I'm going to give her 2.5 milligrams. That's now off label. So that is not within the approved FDA guidelines. So let's apply that to ketamine. Ketamine was on label for general anesthesia. Anything else, if I say here's 10,000 pages of data that shows it can help for depression, doesn't matter. The FDA has to go through the studies to show that it works for depression within a specific dosage, within a specific route, within a specific administration for this diagnosis to give a thumbs up. But I just told you that it's a generic medication. So these large pharma companies are like, oh, yeah, for sure. I'm going to run $100 million of studies for a medicine I don't own so someone else can. No. So unfortunately, in my opinion, a unnamed company that rhymes with Johnson and Johnson decided to, through a subsidiary, create not ketamine. Ketamine exists like this, a right hand and a left hand, mirror images of the same molecule. Ketamine, half of it, it's the S enantiomer and the L enantiomer. So the S enantiomer, S ketamine, they took this half of the mirror molecule, S ketamine. They don't give it intravenously or orally. They put it in nasal spray and ran all of the studies on this new derived molecule, S-ketamine, that they own the intellectual property for. So all of the on-label indication that you hear about for Spravato, which is the intranasal spray for S-ketamine, is not true ketamine. It is the half of the mirror image. Okay. It is half of the molecule. And the problem is, there's, like I said, this is a new field. This is a developing field. So there's data that suggests the S-ketamine helps for short-term relief, but L-ketamine, the other half of the mirror image, helps for long-term response. And there is actively a company trying to control the intellectual property for L-ketamine. So this is the problem. So at Sanctuary...
If I can kind of condense that down a little bit, because I'm curious about the totality of this and for our listeners, is any of this work covered by insurance or is it all out of pocket when you say it's off label?
That's the point. Okay. Intravenous ketamine
right.
is not covered.
Right.
And there's a lot of insurances that have literally threatened lawsuits against people sure. who try to get insurance coverage for it. So the only thing that is purely on label coverage right now
yeah.
is the intranasal spray S-ketamine, which we made the decision at Sanctuary at day one. I told you the rule, which is like yeah. family. I want for you what I want for my brother, right. for my wife, for my mom, right. for my dad, which is we made the decision at day one of what we would want to treat our family members with. And the answer is intravenous ketamine hydrochloride, real ketamine. And there's three very simple reasons to me why. The first is an infusion, an IV infusion is low, constant, steady state. It is not what's called a bolus, where you give everything at once and then their blood, the concentration goes up super high and then peaks and goes away. If you give something by mouth, you get 100% and then you respond to it. You give something by nose, you spray it and you get however much of it, you get all of it at once. You give intramuscular, you get it all at once. Intravenous is a low, slow, steady, continuous infusion. It also leaves you with an IV access. So if someone has an allergic reaction, if someone has a blood pressure spike, if someone's having a poor response to it, you can stop it and you have a route to give medication. So A, intravenous is a superior route. It's infusion versus bolus. The second reason is called bioavailability, which means out of how much you give, how much reaches the target organ, the brain. If you give something orally, about 25% of what you give gets to the brain. If you give something nasally, about 30% makes it to the brain. If you give it intramuscularly, about 20 to 25% makes it to the brain. If you give it intravenously, 100% of what you put in the vein makes it to the brain. So in terms of how much you're giving, it is not even close, one versus the other. And the third reason is the research, the studies, and the evidence behind it have shown that ketamine hydrochloride, intravenous ketamine, is a superior medication for the response and for the treatment and for the actual improvement that you're looking for this medication. So yes, intranasal is covered by insurance, but even though it's covered, it is for a variety of reasons, in my opinion, and in as a physician, I find it to be an inferior choice, and I do not believe what I want for my loved ones and for my family.
Well, I've certainly been a frontline witness to the challenges of things that are really good for us, but not covered under insurance, and the challenges that are associated with that. Mostly those have been financial. Sometimes they've been more the medical maybe community, but it is certainly challenging when you find something that's really good for you and this so-called concept of big pharma being in the way. We won't talk about being, hey, that's something that we're not making money off of, but yet it's still a good product. There's several of those out there, and I find that this becomes somewhat of a cost burden. But I've also found and been a witness to the fact that a lot of these things are really effective and really impactful to the health and wellness of people who need it. It's powerful.
And that's what we're pushing for at Sanctuary. We're involved with a veteran task force group who's trying to work with generating real world evidence and data to show that this should be covered. It's extremely frustrating, and I certainly understand that. And that's what we are trying to, at Sanctuary, we're trying to help define that gold standard treatment of same way we treat everyone is the way that we treat, you know, we would expect our family to be treated. There's clinics out there that do what's called a PACU or a recovery bay style clinic, which is 10 people in one large room separated by paper sheets, like a recovery from a surgery, getting their infusions all in a row. So think about the diagnoses we've talked about, like major depressive disorder and people who underwent their own personal trauma. I can't imagine how horrible and unsafe it feels to be 4 feet away from someone who's dealing with their own trauma and dealing with their own mental health burdens, that there's no privacy. There's no actual space for yourself. At Sanctuary, we decided to limit the number of patients that we treat in a day because it means everybody gets their own room. Everybody gets their own privacy. Everyone gets their own space to unpack. And, you know, you're in a vulnerable state when you get an anesthetic. And for people who underwent assault and trauma and have a lot of anxiety, it's kind of inappropriate, in my opinion, to be doing that in a group setting. So we are trying to do things the right way, which is not always the easiest way.
So what determines... For our listeners, what determines if a person's a good candidate? How do they know? How do they know, absolutely, hey, this sounds intriguing. How do I know, mm-hmm, if I'm a good candidate? Could this benefit me? How would a person find that out?
Absolutely. So at Sanctuary, we do a consultation, a free consultation for everyone who's a potential candidate, everyone who reaches out to us and has a diagnosis that's applicable. We do a full consultation because at Sanctuary, there's two questions. One is rule in and the other is rule out. Rule in means we want to make sure that you're an appropriate candidate for this therapy, that you have a diagnosis that is appropriate to be treated. I personally, again, trying to define gold standard, I don't think this is a first line treatment for everyone. I think this is for treatment resistant conditions. And I think for patients who have depression, you should have tried conventional therapy. You should have, mm-hmm, tried an initial treatment before you come to this. For trauma, I think initial therapy and traditional psychology, psychiatry is an appropriate first step. And if it's not working, this is very much what is applicable. For chronic pain, if you broke your finger a day ago, you shouldn't come straight to this. If you've never gone under any other treatment, you haven't had any x-rays, there's been no aspirin or Tylenol, and you come straight to this, that's not appropriate. And really, unfortunately, is there's some clinics out there. There's a clinic in California that has on their website a diagnosis of writer's block. that if you have writer's block, you are a candidate for this treatment. And that is unconscionable and horrible and the opposite of medicine. So that's atrocious. So there's the rule in that you have an appropriate diagnosis that can respond to this medication. And then there is the rule out to make sure for patients who should not get this medication. Ketamine increases your blood pressure and it increases your heart rate. It increases the activity and the usage of your heart and of your major vascular structures. If you had a stroke or a heart attack within the last 6 to 12 months, this is not an appropriate therapy for you. Patients with, it's a kind of glaucoma called closed angle glaucoma. Arguably, ketamine can increase the pressure inside of your eyeball a tiny bit. And if you have closed angle glaucoma, you're not an appropriate candidate for it. If you are pregnant or nursing, we don't recommend, pregnant is an absolute not. And if you are actively nursing, we do pump and, my dad's an OB. He's been the one who's kind of helped our protocol for this. There's pump and dump. There's a lot of kind of like safety things for that. Any true allergy to this medication, you should not utilize it. A history of schizophrenia, you should not use this medication. So there are rule ins that you're an appropriate candidate and rule out that you are not an appropriate candidate for this treatment. And I think what's really important to us is there are clinics that we have unfortunately had patients come to us afterwards who say that their entire screening was Visa or MasterCard. That's everything. That was the entire background. There are clinics out there that do not have nursing or CRNAs on staff or in person. Like, that's, again, wildly inappropriate. There are clinics out there that the screening and the initial assessment are not done by healthcare providers. They're done by people reading a script who don't understand what they're saying. That's also like, it really bothers me. So completely unrelated to this conversation, I have the opinion that medical cannabis has a lot of potential. Personally, I think it has its place in medicine. But unfortunately, because it's been so bastardized and turned into purely recreation, and there's so much more focus on marketing and consumer product goods and easy access rather as opposed to medical value, recreationally, do your thing. That's not my business. But medically, I think there is no chance for it to be recognized for any medical potential anymore because it got so diluted and so recreationalized so quickly that there wasn't an actual opportunity to treat it truly appropriately and medically first. I'm not at all anti-cannabis. I am against the way that any medical or scientific value kind of got washed away. So the same thing for ketamine. I am afraid that clinics out there will use it inappropriately or say everybody who wants it, come in and get it. And someone's going to get hurt. And the two things that I can't accept about that is number one, it's going to set back the whole field and people who need help won't get it. And number two is it's not just someone will get hurt and patient number 479 at this clinic in California will get hurt. It's that's someone's mom and that's someone's brother. And it's not appropriate to have this dressed up as a medical therapy, but actually be just using it as a recreational cash grab. That's unacceptable. And people who do that have no place in medicine.
I so appreciate your heart and your passion in this. It certainly comes through when we visit about this. I'm going to pull us back a little bit and get out of the more processes, the more front office processes of this a little bit and go back to pain. I want to spend a little bit of time on pain. We've talked about the mental health aspect of it, but I'm certainly no stranger to having those around me, both in the field and loved ones who have chronic pain. What can you speak to that as just kind of an intro where ketamine fits? And then let's see kind of where the conversation goes on that side of the aisle.
Sure, 100%. 100%. I know we went down that first bucket of mental health kind of deep into the rabbit hole.
Sure.
So from pain, again, I do not think this is a magic bullet. I do not think this is a silver bullet. Sure. I don't think anyone who has any kind of pain will just respond to this. I think there are certain conditions and certain categories of pain that respond particularly well. The category of pain specifically is either neuropathic or nerve-derived pain is a really good category for this. And the second option is these conditions called central sensitization, or areas where the body has hyperreacted to something. There are conditions that used to be called causalgia. Now they're called chronic regional pain syndrome. There are sympathetic conditions where essentially if someone breaks into your car, you want the car alarm to go off. If your neighbor shuts their front door three houses down and your car alarm goes off, it's not really a useful alarm. Pain has its evolutionary purpose. Pain is there to tell you, like, dude, something's wrong with you, burned your hand. Don't be grabbing more stuff with it. Let it heal. Pain wants to say, hey, man, like, I'm like 90% sure you just broke your femur. You probably should not be weight bearing on it. Pain has its purpose. But when you break your leg and pain says, dude, take it easy, try to take it easy, that's good. 6 months after you've had your surgery and your leg is still being like, man, something's like, don't walk on it, something is not okay. 5 years later, your leg is like, hey, man, just so you know, I think you broke your femur 5 years ago. That's still not really helpful. So there's conditions where the body overreacts or is hypersensitive. It's called central sensitization. Normal, there's like allodynia and hyperesthesia. There's both things that should not be painful, like light touches become painful, or hyperesthesia, whereas stuff that is painful, like a scratch, becomes out of proportionately painful. So those kind of central sensitization conditions, like chronic regional pain syndrome, are really good, really appropriate for ketamine, because it allows for that resetting, like we talked about, kind of that nerve reprogramming.
Now, so we're talking about the same concept, right? We're talking about rewiring the neuroplasty of the brain in a relationship to pain now, the pain receptors.
Yes,
sir. Is that
correct?
Am I accurate? I'm sure it's layperson viewpoint, but am I
close? In a nutshell, that is definitely an area where, like, higher nerve processing for it, for sure, but also the two parts of your body that are defined as the central nervous system are your brain and your spinal cord. And so it literally also acts in areas of your spinal cord where these nerves come in and attach and send the signal. If all we are is bags of meat with electrical wiring, the problem is the electrical wiring can malfunction. And so this is something that can help reset the sensitivity, calm down the hyperactivity of some of that central wiring.
I love that. Again, what has been some of your common, let me ask this in a broader way and narrow it down to some of your veteran and first responder community. What has been some of your interactions, if not wins, arguably, when I'll put that word, I'll put it in the framework for you. What has been some of your success stories with some of this, if you don't mind me asking? I obviously you have patient confidentiality, but can you speak to some of that?
I definitely can. And there's a lot of cases that I carry with me because they allow me to keep going. And there's stories that stick with me from pain and from mental health, and definitely
I'd love to hear both.
First responder and veteran perspective. So from pain, I remember one of my first patients that I ever took care of was such a nice girl. And she was, when I first met her for the first time, she was 17 years old. And because of a complex medical history, she had already undergone 2 full intestinal transplants. The first one that failed and had to be removed, and then a second transplant. Because of the repeat surgeries, because of the repeat interventions, she had had what's called an XLAP, exploratory laparotomy. They had opened up her abdomen by age 17 or 18 more than 60 times, like a surreal amount. And so much small damage had happened to the nerves of her stomach, the nerves of the abdominal wall, that she had fairly constant pain. So bioavailability, what we talked about. She was given the nasal ketamine, and it partially worked for her. But because she had so many GI surgeries, she had spent months and years with a tube stuck down her nose to decompress her stomach. Because of all the time she had tubes stuck down her nose, there was so much scar tissue that this medicine wasn't being absorbed. So it worked for a tiny bit, for minutes at a time, and then it just faded right away because she was barely getting any of it. we did ketamine infusions for her, and it changed quality of life. It changed her pain control. It helped her get off narcotics. It was, to me, I mean, again, like, this is, it sticks with me forever. There is one of my favorite cases ever. And so something that is so important, man, something that I find that needs to be said is, dude, look at me. I look like a Make-A-Wish kid. I look like I'm 30 pounds soaking wet. I look like, you know, a stick figure that Pinocchio to real life somehow. So unsurprisingly, I am not a veteran. I do not have the veteran experience, and I don't know the veteran experience. And everyone who says to a veteran, I know what you went through, I just despise people who come forward with that first sentence. It really bothers me. So I do not and could not and I do not have the ability to understand what veteran population has gone through. I don't. I can't. How could you? You know, I know that I don't know. That's full stop. But some of the things that have been said to me by veterans and by some of the special force group that we've treated are with me forever. That my father and I got an incredible text message thanking us for our treatment, saying that that individual no longer remembers what their pistol tastes like. And I had to like walk away from that because it left me kind of like shaken. And I don't really know how to respond to that.
Of course.
So I am very grateful for Dr. Stephen Pappas, who has helped me guide this into like a safe, appropriate, respectful approach for our veteran population. I am very grateful for multiple, you know, our shared friend. I don't know if he wants me to even mention his name, but our shared friend that brought us together.
Of course. No, he would love that. So, his ego would love that.
So his entire organization of Raul and then Survive First and Hook a Hero and a lot of these populations we work with and these groups that we work with have been so humbling for me, and I'm so grateful, and I have so much gratitude for their willingness to work with me and work with us and work with Sanctuary and make sure that, like I said, I want people taken care of the same way I'd want my wife taken care of. These organizations and Survive First and you, your passion is evident that it's clear that we want not just any first responder taken care of the same way we'd want our loved ones and the first responders and the veterans that we know and that we love.
Sure.
We want them taken care of the same way. So I think that's remarkably important to mention that I don't have the veteran experience. I don't know that, but I'm really grateful that people have helped provide that color commentary and provide that perspective to make sure that what we do is done right.
Sure. Important. No, absolutely. No, I love that. And shout out to Raul Ruiz, Trauma Behind the Badge, Survive First, Doug Monda, Doug and Karen Monda, that whole crew. They're amazing people. So, Doc, this has been an absolutely amazing conversation. If I wrap this up, tell us a little bit about if somebody wants more information than what they got today, or they're intrigued by this and say, I want to deep dive this a little bit. How do they find out more information, or how can they find you? How can they find your Sanctuary Healthcare? Tell us how to find you.
For sure. So again, I'm Dr. Evan Peskin. I'm the co-founder of Sanctuary Healthcare. You can find us online at sanctuaryhealthcare.org. If you look up Sanctuary Healthcare, we have a Facebook and an Instagram for people who prefer to reach out that way. Or you can text or call us at 561-464-5382. We're located in Boca Raton, Florida. That's where our flagship clinic is. We're hopefully in the process right now of getting to expand a little bit and reach more people who need more help. But you can always contact us through our website. You can contact us. My personal email for Sanctuary is evan@findyoursanctuary.org. And I would really hope every physician says this, but the reason I went into medicine is to help people who need help. And pain medicine definitely gives me an outlet to do that. I am remarkably grateful for the group that I work with and how they take care of people. But I'm also very grateful that my path led me down this route for Sanctuary, gave me an opportunity to help people in a way that I never anticipated or never expected. And I hope more than anything, I hope if one person hears this and it makes a difference for them, then everything is worth it.
Well, this has been fabulous. And again, the No One Fights Alone podcast is all about bringing resources, experience, strength, and hope to the listeners. And you've certainly done that today. Doc, I appreciate your time and thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Dude, I want to thank you. Thank you for having me. Thank you for creating this medium and this conduit to get access to people who need it. Again, my wife makes fun of me. I'm never going to say one nice thing about myself ever, because that's not really who I am. But I want to mention, dude, you tell me my passion, it is evident. Yours is for what you do and who you care for and who you get to reach. So the opposite. I'm extremely grateful for you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Doc.
Chateau Health and Wellness is a 16-bed treatment facility nestled in the foothills of the Wasatch Mountains in Midway, Utah. Chateau's first responder resiliency program is designed to treat the unique challenges and issues that first responders encounter in the course of their careers. Chateau's comprehensive and highly individualized approach to treatment addresses more than just the presenting issues. It addresses the why. Each of their seasoned, trauma-trained, and culturally competent therapists utilize evidence-based, specialized therapies to treat trauma at its core and enable clients to begin the healing process while developing a resilient and healthy relationship with stress. Chateau Health and Wellness is trusted by departments and agencies from around the country to treat responders and veterans. In fact, it is one of only a handful of facilities nationwide that is vetted and approved to treat members of the Fraternal Order of Police. For more information or to speak to a representative, go to chateaurecovery.com or call 888-507-5031.